Welcome everyone to Freedom Law School's weekly conference call on this October 26, 2017. This is Payman Mutahede, the founder and president of Freedom Law School and your host for this weekly program. I founded Freedom Law School, folks, in 1996, over 20 years ago, to help educate and empower average, ordinary Americans like you to live free of oppressive taxation and control. And folks, Freedom Law School now is the oldest, longest running, most successful tax honesty organization in the history of the tax honesty movement since World War II. Freedom Law School itself and the students of Freedom Law School have an impeccable track record of beating the IRS, living free. That you can see a partial list of that, only a partial list, on our website at livefreenow.org. If you've not educated yourself about what Freedom Law School offers, take advantage of it. Go to livefreenow.org, sign up, and you're going to get your freedom education package mailed to you at no charge. And you're going to get every few weeks the education package emailed to you so you can listen and study at your own leisure and convenience about the U.S. Constitution, the law, your rights, and the proper procedures and steps you need to know and apply to live free. And folks, you don't have to be an attorney. You don't have to be a lawyer to know the basics of your rights. That is what makes Freedom Law School different. It's helping the average person to understand the law and make it easy to understand. Tonight I'm going to talk about the topic of the Uniform Commercial Code, otherwise known and abbreviated as UCC. As far as does it have, what kind of an effect on your rights? Does it in what way perhaps protect or preserve your rights and your property from the IRS and government violation of your rights? It's a topic that's been talked about a lot in the freedom movement for many decades. I'll be addressing that with my esteemed guest, Larry Beecraft, who has been a freedom lawyer for over 40 years. But before I get to that, folks, I want to remind you all, if you haven't done already, check out our website. Go to the educational material of Freedom Law School, folks. That is the most basic, simple, easy to understand, and verifiable information you will get there. For example, our $300,000 income tax reward will give you a very good overview of some of the key issues surrounding the income tax legality question. And then we're going to get into the speech of a former IRS special agent, Joseph Bannister, one of my students, a gun-carrying agent, which I'll be having on one of these calls in the near future, of how he left the IRS because he found out the gun and the badge they gave him as a special agent was being abused by him and by the IRS, that there was no law requiring the average American like you to file and pay the federal income tax. People get into that and more educational videos. And a law professor, folks, from a very famous law school, George Washington Law School in D.C., he attempted to claim Freedom Law School's $300,000 income tax reward. And just a refutation of what he said with direct links to the IRS code sections and Supreme Court cases gave me an opportunity to show you what a scam and a fraud the income taxes, and how the people in the government, the deep state, like this lawyer professor used to be part of deep state of the federal government, Department of Injustice, how they are misapplying and misportraying the IRS Code of Supreme Court decisions to feed their monster, the federal government that we have today, not the one that was envisioned and we had during the times of the founding fathers and a few decades after that. So folks, get ready, because we're going to cover the subject that a lot of people talk about. By the way, let me say this, folks. Education is number one at Freedom Law School. That's why one of the key things that I always say is, do not believe me. Do not believe the government. Do not believe anybody out there on the internet either. Go look up and verify things for yourself. You can look things up in the law library or online. You can find IRS code sections and Supreme Court decisions and read the law for yourself, for what it says. And you decide what those letters, those words mean. They're actually not that hard to understand. And that's why if you go, for example, on YouTube and type in using the law library or how to use the law library, Freedom Law School's course will be the first one that comes up that you'll see. Yep. You'll come up, you'll see it, and check it out, because that will help you a lot to sift through the mountain of information that you find on the internet about these issues of income tax, your rights, and freedom. So let's talk about this thing called the Uniform Commercial Code. Uniform Commercial Code was developed a long time ago for the purpose of the states hopefully having their laws of commerce be more in harmony together, so that when somebody does business, for example, in Alabama and then Mississippi and Tennessee, as they go through state lines, the law, the rules don't change, because the rules can change. Because as you may know, you should know, in America, we have 50 countries or states in the union, each with their own legislatures, constitutions, and lawmaking that they do. So it was during the 1800s, business was made difficult, because if you went from one state to another, within a few weeks, you had different rules that would apply to you and the guy you did business with. So Uniform Commercial Code was put together to harmonize these state laws as much as possible. It was a set of rules that the states could adopt, a set of laws that the states could adopt or not. It was the state's choice. And then, of course, each state has its own commercial laws. Like in California, where I came from, there was a, you know, commercial code. It's about rules that apply to commerce. You buy, you know, a truckload of oranges, you know, or deliver a bunch of chairs, you know, to business. You know, you sell it to them. It's laws of commerce. And so that is what the Uniform Commercial Code is. And UCC is the abbreviation of that. And of course, you hear in the Freedom Movement quite often things like, well, you should sign a document under UCC 1-207 or UCC 1-305. Sometimes also it is suggested you write under that reservation of all rights, or write under that rights reserved without prejudice, or without prejudice, all rights reserved. And similar things. that we hear on the internet that uniform commercial code could be used in these ways to protect your rights, defend your rights, and live free of oppressive taxation and control. Well, the first guy that I heard about this uniform commercial code, I gotta mention him because he is the grandfather of the uniform commercial code movement. The argument of the uniform commercial code was developed by a gentleman named Howard Freeman, who I heard his speech on audio CD, audio tape at the time, in 1993, 24 years ago. And he talked about, in his opinion, he was saying that during a 1933, when the U.S. government went off the bank off gold standard, the bank in effect had seized all the gold because U.S. government was bankrupt, could not pay the banks, and the U.S. government was taken into receivership as a bankrupt entity. And so at that time, common law disappeared. It used to be under common law, and it was replaced with statutory law. And so, and some, of course, I heard people say admiralty law or law, military jurisdiction. And so, but because there had to be a thread left back to the U.S. Constitution, which is based upon common law, the common law itself. And because this was done through laws of commerce, this whole bankruptcy of the United States, where our gold was taken from the U.S. government, that thread back to common law and the Constitution was the Uniform Commercial Code. And by signing things UCC1-207, which is the abbreviation of Uniform Commercial Code, Section 1-207, you get to reserve your rights under the Commerce Code. Even though you're going along with this corrupt system that we have involuntarily, you don't want to go along with it, but you're forced to go along with this commercial forced process on you. You're reserving your rights. You're not giving up your rights. You're still retaining them, holding on to them. In essence, you're saying, like, there's a gun to my head and I'm giving you my wallet only because you have a gun to my head. I still reserve my rights to do whatever I may need to do to get my wallet back from you or not give it to you. So when I heard that back in 1993 in the audio tape of Howard Freeman that I got, I was very new to the freedom movement, folks. I got started about... it was about May, I think, or April of 1992. I got started with a group called the Pilots Connection Society, and who introduced me to the Freedom Patriot Movement. And those people introduced me to others and others and other people like Howard Freeman. I thought, wow, this is interesting. This is different than what Pilot Connection Society was saying. And I wasn't sure whether Howard Freeman was right, or the Pilot Connection Society. Later on, of course, I heard about, a few months later, about the state versus U.S. citizenship theory, which I covered last week on the conference call. You want to get that call if you are interested to find out more on that subject. So I was quite a little bit bewildered in those early days, which is really the right way to go, because they seemed contradictory to each other, which is the way to go. Adhesion contact theory that the Power Connection Society was saying, or UCC or state citizenship. Because the Power Connection Society was saying that when you open a bank account, and they had an article by Mr. Mercier, which I got from the package they sold me for $1,500. And Mercier's essay said that when you open a bank account, because the bank is the privilege of the king, and the king in America is the legislature, and the legislature created the, allowed the banks to exist, do what they do, the Federal Reserve. Your bank signature card that you sign when you open a bank account, the piece of paper you sign to open up the account, basically. There's an agreement in there that they all have it in there that you agree to abide by all the rules and regulations of the bank, which include your requirement to file for income tax, because it requires you to be a taxpayer in that process. So that's what I was taught. And UCC was saying a different thing, UCC approach. So folks, to discuss this issue further, I want to bring my co-host for tonight's call and most renowned experienced constitutional lawyer in America for 42 years, folks. This man has been studying the law as a profession. And most of that, he's been a constitutional freedom lawyer, focusing on the monetary issues, monetary aspects of the Constitution and economics, because he, his interest, just like me, was originally with economics and how the world works, how money works. And just like me, he got into law as a result of that initial love of economics and how money works, how the world works. And so he's the most experienced lawyer I know in the freedom movement, in the history of the movement, because he started at such a young age, and right now in his late 60s. I had the pleasure of knowing him for over 20 years, and we've been sharing a lot of information over the years, a lot of research. And so let me bring you Mr. Laramie Craft from Huntsville, Alabama, who's going to be helping me answer your questions and tell you how UCC can or may not help you protect and preserve your rights when it comes to the IRS. Because tonight, folks, you're going to get the answers you need to hear, the truth. We're going to give it to you, the unvarnished truth and usefulness of this information. Okay, Mr. Bucraft, thank you for being on the call with me.
Hey, Payman, how you doing? Did you want me to say some things about the UCC, or can I make some other comments about other matters too?
Well, let me hear about first. How did you hear about UCC theory? What did you come across the first time, Larry?
Well, about the same thing that you did. You know, it is back in the early 90s. You know, people, I started seeing, you know, back, we didn't have the internet back then. Newsletters would come out and they'd say something about the UCC. And then I saw pictures of people that be driving around, they'd have a license plate on their car, UCC 1-207. You know, the little indicators like that. Then I started looking into it, and then somebody provided to me an audio tape of that Howard Freeman speech, you know, and that's the basis for everything. And it's been around for 20 years, and I just kind of think that the people that are following that argument need to really know its effectiveness.
Well, Larry, you had some experience with the individuals who attempted to use UCC. What have you seen, how it's worked for some of these individuals who focus on using UCC to preserve their rights?
Well, you know, a lot of people are going to run around, and this happens with any argument that you're raising. You know, if you've got a controversy with some government agency, state or federal, you can throw just a bunch of stuff against the wall and it'll stick, you know, primarily because they don't want to deal with you. It's not worth the effort. So, you know, there are some stories about there, well, I use UCC and you know, the IRS went away. Well, what happens if that doesn't happen to you, if you're not left alone? Well, I've seen too many people use the UCC argument, and
well,
there's a lot of fundamental...
It might interrupt you, Larry. Let me address that, if I may, because that's a very key point. I hear that a lot. I heard that years ago, that I did this UCC thing or some other patriot argument, and IRS left me alone. If I may address that, Larry, this is the most common logical mistake that I see patriots make. The IRS wrote him a letter. Most often, folks, the IRS letters are computer-generated, dumb letters. Nobody thought about it, like junk mail. They are sent out automatically to millions of people like you without no human involvement. The computer just sends it out, like junk mail. And they may request a tax return from you or some other letter, or remind you that you may owe them some money from past years. And then the IRS sends you no follow-up letters, 2 months, 6 months, 4 years, they leave you alone with no follow-up letters. So people tell me that, based upon my experience, it's clear to me that what I did, the UCC I did, or whatever I did, or UCC filing, or XYZ I did, that's the reason IRS left me alone. That worked. Well, folks, think about that argument. How is that different from this example I'm going to give you? Somebody tells you that if you want it to rain, go to the back of your house, put on a military hat, wear some shorts, put one sock but on your left leg, but on your right leg, look up at a tree 500 yards away, say, kick-ka-kuchi-ka-ta-ta, clap your hands 5 times, snap your fingers 6 times, and another half hour later, it will rain. And you go out there and do exactly that, and lo and behold, half hour later, it rains. Would you go tell all your friends? Aha! It worked! This guy says, if I want to rain, I have to do this thing, go to the back of my house, look at the tree 500 yards away, one sock on my left foot, none on the other, you know, say, ha-ku-chi-ka-ku-ta-ta, clap my hands 5 times, snap 6 times, and it will rain half hour later. See, you wouldn't think about concluding that, but that's what happens in the freedom movement, Larry. I see that people assume that just because the IRS didn't write them, that the IRS did not follow up because the IRS agreed with them. But the fact is, folks, IRS doesn't take the time to read your letters or your responses. They don't. Most IRS employees are not educated. They have about 100,000 employees, of which about 75,000 of them are merely clerks. But the 25,000 are managers, criminal agents, special agents, collection agents, auditors, managers. So 25,000 people cannot read the letters of the nation of 300 plus million Americans and tons of millions of corporations that file tax returns. So they just simply ignore your letters. And on top of that, folks, they're very lazy and incompetent. So when they could come after you, maybe they should send follow-up letters if they were efficient, they don't. So if they don't follow up with you, it does not mean they agreed with you or your arguments about UCC or whatever else. That's in my experience with that, Larry, which I want to address. What do you think about that?
I agree. You know, you could send them a letter saying, you know, the moon is made out of green cheese, and that's the substance of your letter. And there are situations in which nothing would happen to anybody after that letter went in. That doesn't mean it has any substance, but that's just the way the system operates. You know, there is no program in place that they're going to follow through every time with everybody once they go through certain steps. So, you know, they can send you a letter and you can respond to it, but, you know, they do that with 10,000 other people. You know, out of that 10,000 people, you know, there's going to be maybe 3,000 or 4,000 that they'll never do anything with. You know, that's just statistics. You fall through the cracks. The agency doesn't respond. You know, you're just off the board. However, if you are a party that they've gone after, then, you know, you have to have something, some meat, and you better know the administrative procedures. You know, what the agency typically does in a given situation. Now, do you want me to comment upon the UCC argument?
Yes, please, Larry. Go ahead.
Well, can I make some comments about some other things that kind of precede that?
Sure. Please go ahead.
Well, there's a lot of stuff that goes around right now about common law. And you were mentioning, you know, the people that are using the UCC, and you know, wanting to reach back into the common law. I think there needs to be some, at least some comments, at least a little bit of understanding about what the common law really is. You know, the people that are running around right now making arguments about the common law are really, those are people that idealize the common law without really knowing what it is. Back in 1066, the Norman conquest of England happened. As a result of that, you know, medieval forms of government on the continent came over to England. England didn't have, you know, what they had in Europe at the time. But under this medieval system, there was the results of the Norman conquest of 1066. William the Conqueror set up, you know, a new form of government for England. That new form of government basically had estates. The king owned everything, and everybody else below him were his, you know, subtenants, so to speak. And, you know, the political and governmental order was created by this hierarchical ranking between, you know, the king owns everything, he sublets great estates to, you know, lords below him. You know, that's the way you back in those days when you didn't have writing and other means of communications, everything was primarily oral, everything was primarily tradition. You know, that's the way governments were structured, and that's the way England was structured. Now, over several hundred years, you know, there was a transition from the king owning everything to, there was a gradual acknowledgement of rights of the subtenants below the king, and slowly over the hundreds of years, the vested interests of the tenants below the king were recognized until, you know, ultimately the king really wasn't the owner. By a process of accretion, the title to land, so to speak, had been transferred from the king to his tenants. That's one point. Another point is, you know, the way common law operates is overblown. It's kind of idealized in this movement. You know, people think it's God's law. Well, you know, I kind of disagree with that. You know, Christianity certainly had an influence upon the English common law, but to say that the common law is, you know, the manifestation of God's form of government on the face of the earth is a stretch of the imagination. And in fact, if you want to see common law criminal procedures in effect today, go over to the Muslim countries. And what have we seen in Muslim countries? You know, they'll accuse somebody, you know, they'll have a quick trial, and boom, they're dead. Well, the same thing happened under the English common law. You know, Sir Thomas More was, Henry VIII's, one of his trusted advisors. Thomas More believed that, you know, the king could not be the head of a church. And King Henry had made himself the king, the head of the Church of England. Well, you know, that's just a philosophical disagreement. However, the queen wanted, you know, Sir Thomas More put on trial for treason. He was. He had, you know, as soon as the accusations are made, you know, within a couple of weeks, you're going to be going to trial. You know, there's going to be a judgment of your peers. You know, you didn't even have the right to testify at common law in a criminal procedure. Parties were disbelieved because they had an interest in the case. And so a defendant couldn't testify. And so they would have these trials, you know, no rules of evidence, no real established procedure. If you were found guilty, you know, the execution happened pretty quick. You know, not everybody that was convicted of some crime was killed, but in Sir Thomas More's case, who did nothing other than disagree with the king over whether or not a monarch could be the head of a church, you know, as a result, he was drawn, quartered, beheaded, and hanged. And his skull was put up with several hundred others on the London Bridge. Well, you know, if you take a look at what the common law criminal procedure that was in effect back in those days, it had an influence all the way up until, you know, the mid-19th century in this country, in the 1850s and 1860s. You had no right to appeal the criminal conviction. once you went through a trial, and there were no rules of evidence that were, you know, carefully outlined, punishment came swiftly. And we used to look at these old cowboy movies. You know, the cattle rustler would be sitting in jail, and they're, and you know, the TV would, the camera would show the window outside the jail, and they're building a something to hang the guy. You know, he's been convicted. Think about the Lincoln assassination. You know, the parties that were charged with the Lincoln assassination, within a month of the Lincoln assassination, they were on trial. The trial lasted a month. And in July of 1865, 10 days after the verdict came in, back in that case, all of the defendants were hung. So to say today that, you know, the common law, we have a whole lot of common law in this country. You know, here in Alabama, you know, our law regarding real property is based on the common law. You know, our law regarding torts or personal injuries, that's based on the common law. You know, a lot of common law still is in effect in a lot of the states. But to, you know, glamorize it and to say it's amounts to God's law is a big stretch of the historical proof, the historical evidence, because the historical evidence, the history of the common law demonstrates something otherwise. But now, getting around to commercial transactions, you know, when this country was created, you know, Uncle Sam only had the constitutional authority over interstate commerce. Oh, that's the broadest power that Congress has, you know, internally inside this country to regulate interstate commerce. Well, there's, you know, there's a such a thing known as intrastate commerce. Uncle Sam doesn't have any constitutional authority to regulate and control intrastate commerce. That is the commerce inside the states. Well, that's something that falls within the legislative power of a state legislature. Now, back in the 1850s, 1860s, 1870s, you know, the commercial laws. Now, you have commercial laws regarding, you know, deeds and mortgages and checks and, you know, contracts and secured transactions. You know, each state just kind of had its own law. So as Payman said earlier, you know, the commercial laws in 1870 in Alabama were different from the commercial laws in Tennessee. So if you live like where I am in Huntsville, Alabama, if I drive 20 miles north and I'm in Tennessee, you know, back in those days, of course, you couldn't drive it in 20 minutes, but it was within a day's carriage ride. You know, you're walking into a completely different jurisdiction where the laws are different. Back in the late 1880s and 1890s, you know, there were a bunch of these pointy-headed legal scholars got together and said, hey, this doesn't make sense. Let's make things uniform throughout the country. So you had these study groups created to, you know, make laws more uniform. So they came out with the Uniform Negotiable Instruments Law. You know, that's something they did back in the late 1800s and the early 1900s. These people would go out and say, hey, it's beneficial. It'll help commerce for the negotiable instruments law to be similar in every state. So over the years, there's been an effort to make the commercial laws be more uniform. So back in about 1939, 1940, a bunch of these, you know, scholars got together and said, hey, you know, we've created a bunch of these uniform laws. Now we're going to come out with a uniform commercial code. So they sat down and, you know, came up with a, you know, after much debate and much drafting, they came up with a code, a suggested code, that they could present to a state legislature and a state legislature could adopt, you know, to for the purpose of making the transactions, commercial transactions, more uniform across the country. So since that time, you know, what Alabama didn't get around to adopting it until about 1975. You know, the large parts of the Uniform Commercial Code were finally adopted by Louisiana, you know, our one state in this country that doesn't have a common law tradition. You know, it has the Napoleonic Code, Louisiana. But they've adopted a large part of the Uniform Commercial Code. But the only reason for the Uniform Commercial Code has not been adopted in toto by every state. I don't know that a single state hasn't adopted it without substantial changes to it. However, it is uniform. The major features in all the states are roughly the same. However, you know, the commercial laws in Texas regarding oil and gas are going to be vastly different from the commercial laws regarding oil and gas in Vermont. I doubt that there are any commercial oil and gas laws in Vermont. They probably don't need it. But the negotiable instruments laws in New York State are going to be a lot more highly developed than in Idaho. So there's each state has its own differences. The Uniform Commercial Code is not one law that applies in all 50 states. It is a suggested law that a lot of states, well, all the states have come along and adopted major features of it, but there's little nuances between each state. However, the thing that's so important, the redeeming feature of the Uniform Commercial Code is, you know, now you can take a, you know, you can have a student that, you know, let's say Memphis State in Memphis, Tennessee. He's sitting there, you know, within a short distance of Memphis and Arkansas, and he's sitting in Tennessee. He can study in business school, you know, a course on UCC that'll get him the, you know, taught about the major features of it. So then if he goes to work over in West Memphis, Arkansas, you know, where they're going to have another version of the Uniform Commercial Code, it's real easy for somebody like that that's going to be, he's going to work for a large company and dealing in contracts and sales and secured transactions. Hey, he's going to be able to quickly get brought up to speed. That's the value of the Uniform Commercial Code. However, it is not a federal law. Congress doesn't have the authority to adopt the Uniform Commercial Code and make it applicable inside the states. There is no such constitutional authority. And furthermore, the Uniform Commercial Code only applies to commercial transactions, and it has nothing to do with our relationship with either a municipal government, a state government, or the federal government. So for those that come along and say, you know, that, you know, gee, you can throw this UCC argument out to the IRS and expect that it's going to have some impact, you know, I know it's promoted in that fashion. However, it simply does not work that way.
So basically, UCC has no relations, Larry, to the IRS, does it?
No, it doesn't. You know, that is not a commercial transaction. You know, there's nothing for sale. You're not going to the IRS and buying a TV and getting a, you know, making a down payment, and the IRS is going to retain a security interest in the TV that was sold to you or a car that was sold to you. There's nothing commercial about that relationship. Even though you can paint, you can invent histories in this country like Howard Freeman did with, you know, talking about, you know, the bankruptcy of the United States in 1933 as a result of H.G.R. 192. That's part of the argument. You know, the H.G.R. 192 did not create a bankruptcy of the United States. That's an argument that's been around for a whole time. However, it's a figment of people's imagination. And then to also say that the Erie Railway case, you know, made, you know, it's been just only a couple of years. The last time I saw this argument, there were people talking about, oh, the Erie Railway case, you know, banished the common law. The courts can't cite any case before 1938. You know, that's crazy. there's a lot of people will try to, they know a little bit of history there. They know a rumor about some historical fact, you know, related to something else. And then they'll sit down and spin all of these rumors that they've heard into a tall tale. And, you know, to me, that's what happened with the UCC argument. It, unfortunately, has been around for a long time, and it really has accomplished nothing but causing people to spin their wheels. And, you know, I've seen a lot of these organizations that have come up, you know, advocate some type of an argument, and, you know, people try it out. And, you know, the promoters are associated with the freedom movement. And then, you know, the average American comes in and tries this routine advocated by somebody in the freedom movement. It doesn't work. You know, the freedom movement suffers a black eye because, you know, we've got somebody out there promoting stuff that's not working.
And then what happens is that it doesn't work for them, and they lose, and they give up on their quest for freedom.
Right.
Or
right.
they go to another basic legal theory to rely upon, which doesn't work again. And then eventually what happens, Larry, because it did not work for them, they say, oh, none of this works. Nothing works. The system is absolutely so corrupt. Just go back to the system and give up fighting. Don't educate yourself. Don't do anything else. That's been my experience with that, Larry. How about
yeah,
yours?
Yeah, that's true. Absolutely true. Absolutely true. And I also kind of think that, you know, some of these, you know, to me, the UCC argument, to see it being promoted all over again, you know, the people that have been promoting it for these decades have obviously seen, you know, within a couple of years, if you're promoting it, you ought to see that it's not going to get anywhere. And that should cause you to say, hey, something's wrong. It doesn't work. It is wrong. But for it to continue to be promoted leads me to the conclusion that there's an interest of those that are on the side of the government, in my view, they'd like to see the basis arguments continue to be promoted. I think there's substance to that position.
Well, so, Larry, I think we can take some calls. Some people with questions are on the call with us to ask some questions of us. We have a call from America 336, and we will get to you momentarily, my friend. But if you have a question, folks, on the UCC or any other freedom issue, IRS issue, traffic tickets, government violation of your rights, whether it's the county, the federal, state, we want to help you live free, folks. Okay, and on this conference call, it's going to get some answers and directions to help you find at least a direction you need to go and give you some straight answers. And if you have a question, press 1 on your keypad, and that will let me know you have a question. So if you have a question, push 1 on your telephone keypad, and you'll be on a list of people to get your questions answered. Let's go to the caller from area code 336. Give me your first name, my friend, and tell me how you heard about Freedom Law School, and then your question, please.
Hey, Jan, is that question directed at me? This is Al after
yes,
calling.
Sir. Yes, the gentleman from area code 336 area code. Yes, sir. What'd you like to know?
On behalf of North Carolina, I apparently am the only one from North Carolina on this call. I don't have any questions now. I don't know if Larry Becraft even remembers me. We had lunch once before years ago. The UCC is a marvelous document for people to read and just to understand. And Larry, I think your point that it's a code for commercial transactions couldn't be more clearly understated. It's a way we function in this country. We are a capitalist country. We operate by business transactions, and there.
Hold on, Michael. Hold on. What is your name? What are we going to call you? What's your name first?
Al.
Al. And how did you hear about Freedom Law School, by the way, Al?
Al, I've known about Freedom Law School for at least 20 years. When I was operating my business in North Carolina, I came across your site and your name, and I've been following you through the years. I haven't been participating because I've just been busy for the last 20 years with issues that I've been dealing with, including a case I had in federal court 17 years ago. It'll be 17 years in January.
Okay, I remember who you are now. Yes, I know who you are, my friend. So do you have a question you want to ask? It was the topic of the call tonight, Al, is the UCC. We like to, boss through question and answers, Al. Help others who will listen and watch this call down the road on Blog Talk Radio or YouTube to have access to a good source of information about this issue. Do you have any question on the subject, my friend, you want to ask either Larry or myself, Al?
Well, he was making some comment about, you know, what it does do, is my understanding. Yeah,
Go ahead. Anything else you want to ask Larry or I? about UCC?
At this point, no, I don't. I'm actually wanted to listen in on the call and hear the other listeners and their points of view.
Are you from Charlotte, Asheville, Raleigh, where?
Winston-Salem for 35 years. I'm not there now. My ventures have taken me across the country to Los Angeles, but I'm eventually going to make my way back to North Carolina.
Yeah, the big difference between the West Coast and North Carolina.
Yeah. It was probably a mistake coming here, but it happened, and I have to deal with it.
You need to get back into the mountains.
Oh, absolutely true, and Lake Norman and just north of Charlotte.
Yeah. Well, good. We've enjoyed the conversation.
Oh, thank you.
Well, thank you for your call on the Commerce Call. I appreciate that. Does anybody else have any questions, folks? If you do, go ahead and push 1 on your telephone keypad. That will let us know you have a question to ask. And now, I want to be, before we do that, though, I want to add something else there, which is I found a key to this issue of UCC and other Patriot theories that are out there. One of the key things that seems to be the assumption of UCC arguments and others is that if you do the UCC correctly, or whatever that Patriot theory is, the judge has to and will rule in your favor because you've done this paperwork correctly and the judge's hands are tied. But my experience has been, Larry, that the judges, there are some good judges out there. I've come across nice, honest, and honorable judges. And I've come across corrupt, criminal, totally useless, evil judges that knowingly and deliberately ignore the law, ignore the facts, ignore your arguments, and change your argument to something else and answer that out of context. And the courts of appeal are the same way. I've seen good decisions from courts of appeal, and sometimes the courts of appeal are so corrupt, they also rubber stamp the evil decision of the corrupt judge, which is not being an unbiased trier of fact and law, but acting like a political judge, like in a third world military dictatorship, where the judges bend over backwards to suit the needs of the government and rule in favor of the government. And all these arguments.
Yeah, that's
like
alive and well in America.
Yeah. That's what's going on in America. These people are making excuses by this argument that the judges are violating our rights because we don't know about UCC or this loophole that exists. But is there a loophole at all for people to go through, in your opinion, Larry?
Well, what I've seen people use the UCC argument, let's say that they get sued. And then they do some, you know, typically the UCC is used as some form of defense when you're being attacked in court. And then they'll do something like, you know, the complaint is a commercial instrument. You know, I've heard, that argument. I've even heard arguments that an indictment is a commercial instrument. You know, the redemption people make the argument, oh, gee, you know, they gotta fund the criminal prosecution so they sell the indictment to the gnomes in Zurich, Switzerland. You know, that doesn't happen. An indictment has no commercial value. It's just a document that's a majority of a grand jury has agreed. It sets forth a charge against a crime allegedly committed by the defendants. Their probable cause for it. That's the only purpose of an indictment. That's the only purpose of any type of criminal complaint. To say it has some type of commercial value is, you know, erroneous. You know, that's just. But you know, there are people that are running around and saying, "Oh, you know, you got to respond. You got to accept the indictment for value, and tell the judge that there's no controversy." You know, those arguments get you absolutely nowhere. And you know, this argument's been around a long time that you can take a look at. you know, look up cases where this issue's been raised, and you can see how the courts have responded to it. And there has never been a decision of a court where that argument using the UCC in a battle with the government has ever been successful.
But they think it's successful, Larry, because they wrote to the IRS with UCC, and they got no response from the IRS. So they assumed that, well, IRS must have agreed with me. That's why they didn't respond back. Follow up.
Well, it depends on the length of time that elapses. You know, I can remember you said you got involved with because of Phil Marsh and the Pilot Connection Society. You know, the people that got involved with Marsh's program paid him $1,500. They get these letters, they drop them in the mailbox, and boom, I'm free today. You know, a week goes by, nothing happens. You know, they consider that to be a success. Well, you can, you know, utilize one of these programs, and a week goes by, and nothing's happened. You know, well, it's naturally, you know, that's the way the agency does not respond in that fashion. It takes some time. You know, to me, you know, even if you utilize one of these procedures and 3 or 4 years elapses, you know, they still have a tendency to come back. But even if they don't come back, and there's a lot of people, you know, I enjoy meeting somebody that is just being left alone by the government. Great. We've got one citizen that is not being bothered. And they may have even used, you know, sometime in the past, the UCC. But that, you know, there's just a lot of there's a real problem in making a contention that because you have been left alone, that the cause of that is the UCC argument. You know, that, you know, you're just because you're being left alone is because the agency's leaving you alone for any number of reasons. You know, the simple fact of the matter is that when you take a look at when you are absolutely using the UCC arguments in a real existing ongoing battle, how does it help somebody? And I've never seen that it's helped anybody.
In fact, Larry, I think we see people go to prison using the UCC. Like, you sent me a case of a guy named Woodruff, Kevin Paul Woodruff. And we have a decision from the United States District Court in the Northern District of California in 2007 that, you know, this guy tried to argue UCC, and the court just plain ruled against him. Can you tell us a little about that case, perhaps?
Well, you know, the UCC argument is the basis for several things. Some people use it as, you know, when you're a defendant in a civil or a criminal case, you know, you assert defenses. And, you know, a lot of these people are just doing nothing more than using the UCC for asserting defenses. However, the UCC argument is also the foundation for going beyond its use as a defense in a civil or a criminal case. You know, the UCC argument is the basis for, you know, doing things like issuing bills of exchange or issuing, you know, some type of monetary instrument. You know, it's the foundation for those too. So, you know, if somebody's advocating a UCC argument, but they're going to go on the offense and you start doing things like, you know, issuing these drafts, that's where people get into trouble, and that's been there've been a lot of indictments brought against people that have done that type of thing. You've seen it, Payman, the bills of exchange. You know, Eddie Kane was big into bills of exchange. The foundation for the bill of exchange argument is all these arguments about the Uniform Commercial Code. Well, you know, where is Eddie Kane now? You know, he's been through three trials, and he'll probably be in jail for the rest of his life. You know, I've said to you some indictments. You know, Winston Strout, you know, he was promoting the Roger Elvick redemption process all over again. You know, and they were issuing all these drafts. And, you know, you saw that indictment. You know, there's a bunch of people. He was issuing, you know, billion-dollar drafts. wow, that's crazy. You know what? I can't see why somebody wants to, you know, expose themselves to being indicted for utilizing an argument that they're, you know, as Gary says, you know, when people get into trouble, they're falling off of a cliff and they just grab every branch as they go down. And some of these arguments are the branches that people try to grab a hold of as they go down. But, you know, a lot of times it can make matters worse.
Mm-hmm. And some other patriot leaders who use UCC and gone to prison, I think you can maybe, was the gentleman named Glenn Unger, I believe, that he was used UCC and didn't work for him. And then Tim
Glenn
Turner
Unger,
also did the same thing.
Well, Glenn Unger was really, you know, this is what's surprising to me, and this is when, you know, back in about 2007, 2008, you know, Tommy Cryer and I were kind of surprised that, you know, start hearing this Dr. Sam Kennedy, who had a radio program on, you know, some internet radio program that had a large following. But, you know, he was advocating, based upon what Winston Shrout was telling him, filing these tax returns that I've commonly called the 1099 OID tax return. You know, that idea was given to Dr. Sam Kennedy, whose real name is Dr. Glenn Unger. He wasn't an MD. He was a dentist. But he got all these ideas from Winston Shrout. Well, Dr. Sam Kennedy, also known as Dr. Glenn Unger, is now serving a 12-year jail sentence. Well, you know, the Winston Shrout has just been convicted here within the last couple of months of, you know, doing things like issuing billion-dollar, you know, promissory notes or bills of exchange or something like that. He'll have sentencing coming in January. But he got the idea for all of this based on the redemption process that Roger Elvick started back in 1998-1999. And all of this, you know, there's a this false history, so to speak, of, you know, HJR 192 back in 1933, and, you know, the UCC, and, you know, the Erie Railway case, you know, that's the foundation for several different arguments. It's certainly the foundation for the UCC argument, and the UCC argument then becomes a foundation for, you know, people like Barton Buttes. You remember Barton Buttes, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Okay, you know, yep. He was doing bills of exchange. Eddie Kane was doing bills of exchange. You know, that's the next progression from a UCC argument. And then a next progression from the UCC argument for Sam Kennedy and Winston Shrout and James Timothy Turner, you know, all of those arguments are also based on the UCC. So the historical foundation and a legal foundation for the, you know, the UCC argument becomes a foundation for other arguments that have got a lot of people in trouble. And that's the reason why I was making the vision earlier in the course of this program. Some people are just using the UCC as a defense in court. That's just the pure UCC argument. Others are using the UCC argument. They're adding another layer to it, you know, some type of commercial instrument that they're going to use to satisfy, you know, a tax lien or a foreclosure or something like that. And, you know, that, too, is based upon the UCC argument. And, you know, those arguments, too, are used as an offense, the offensive use of the UCC argument. But those arguments, too, have no substance, and they've gotten a lot of people into trouble, especially the people that have been promoting them.
Very good, Larry. Well, folks, these conference calls are 1 hour or 2 hour long. It depends on the length of the caller's questions, how many people have questions tonight or not. Last conference call, we could have gone over 2 hours, but we had to cut it off at 2 hours. This conference call, we have a little less people calling, folks. So we here, Larry and I, to answer your questions, any of your freedom questions. Remember, Freedom Law School is here to answer your questions, help you live free. What you could do is start with Freedom Law School's very first course, which is called A Practical Road to Freedom, From Oppressive Taxation and Control Level 1. And that course is only $300, over 20 hours of audio, an hour and a half of video, and it comes with a 100% unconditional money-back guarantee, because it is the thing you want and need to know. You don't have to fall for the latest patriot mythologies you see out there. You can learn real law, real procedures that actually do work, and you can have wins and victories in your life, folks. It's up to you to decide to take the time a little bit, learn how to look up and verify things in the law library online these days. So easy. And then not rely on just somebody telling you something is so. Do not believe anybody, me, the government, anybody out there. And once you can understand the law, the basics of it, folks, you are already started your journey to freedom. Phil Moss will here to assist you, back you up in your journey to freedom. Laird, do you have any last parting words to our listeners before we end the call tonight?
I look at what's going on in America, and, you know, I do not think that the future is bright for the typical American citizen. And the reason for that is that we've enabled or permitted or allowed a huge, monstrous federal government to grow. A lot of the reason why the federal government has grown outside of its britches is due to the Federal Reserve System. You know, it's got an endless source of credit, and so it can build a huge government. But, you know, that huge government is going to be, you know, is now laying plans for where it wants America to go in the future. You know, the future is going to, they're going to want to have an electronic currency. And electronic currency, money that doesn't exist, is going to be detrimental to the American people. But then that electronic money that they want to force on us is going to make it a lot more effective, their tax mechanism. Now, to me, the tax mechanism that is being used by the federal government, primarily the federal income tax, you know, when you sit down and you take a look at the law, boy, there are huge holes in it. And, you know, the IRS says a whole bunch of things that are damaging to itself, which in those admissions are clear indications that, you know, this tax that we're dealing with is not as broad as the system wants you to believe it to be. But that tax is being used, you know, there's an economic relationship between the tax and the monetary system. You know, the tax is used to suck excess credit out of the economy so that this paper machine, this credit machine known as the Federal Reserve, can continue operating. You know, all of these scenarios, you know, the existence of the federal income tax, the existence of the Federal Reserve, bodes ill for the financial welfare of the American people. And there are things that we can do about it, you know, but it's going to take the part, you know, people are busy in life. You got to make a living. But if you want the future for yourself or your kids to be brighter than what it appears to be on the horizon, it's going to take some work on our part. And you could do, if you just devoted an hour a week to educating yourself about what the problems are and learning what the solutions are, we would be far better down the road. And one of the reasons why Payment is having these calls is to, you know, provide information to people. I do the same thing, provide information to the American people with the hope that, you know, we can build up a movement of the people to grab the future and change it in our favor. That's what I want to do.
Well, Larry, I think that's what keep to listen to this call, I want to do, folks. And I hope you join Larry and I in educating yourself and joining hands with other freedom seekers to return freedom and justice to America. But it all starts with you, educating yourself, folks. It's a famous saying that says, there's nothing more scary than ignorance in action. We want you to act, but we want you to act intelligently, being informed and educated. So Freedom Law School, folks, provide that tool that you need to educate yourself so you can make intelligent moves that will work for you and for all of America. Why do you think Freedom Law School has been around for over 20 years? And the IRS, despite all their attempts, has not been able to put me in jail, indict me, or stop me from speaking about all this stuff. Because I'm educated and prepared. And you want to do the same thing. Get educated, prepared, work with other freedom-minded individuals, with Larry B. Craft, Freedom Law School, others. And together, folks, we can return America to freedom and justice and the rule of law and the Constitution once again. Thank you for listening, everybody.
Hey, David,
Larry. Yes.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I mentioned my website. I've got a my website is Dixieland Law Journal. Just type in Dixieland Law Journal into an internet search engine. When you get there, I've got a lot of stuff posted. You know, I've got the statutes at large, all the old tax acts, all the old tax regulations. All of it's word searchable. And a wealth of information about money and banking, which is my favorite topic. But, you know, there's a file on my front page called Taxation. You know, if you go over to that page, you're going to find more tax information, historical tax information, than you can find at any other place on the internet.
Yes, Larry has a very good website. Yes. So give it one more time. How do they find your website, Larry? What is they got to do is type in what on the internet search engine?
Hey, look, I'm from Huntsville, Alabama. It's the heart of the South. So my website's name is Dixieland, like the heart of Dixie. Dixieland Law Journal. That's my
Thank you.
I enjoyed it, David.
Larry. Thanks for being here, Larry. I very much appreciate it, folks. Have a great evening. We'll be back with you again next Commerce Call Freedom Law School with other informative information to help you live free now. Good night, everybody.
Have a good day. Bye.
Bye-bye.